Okay, notice the title of the study is Passover Flocks. Anybody have an idea of where that name came from? Any idea at all? Ever hear of a book called Passover Flocks? How many of you have read that? What's the basic premise of the book? Anybody that would like to comment? What is the claim? What is the author claiming about Jesus of Nazareth? First of all, he doesn't claim that he didn't exist. He acknowledges he's a historical figure. But what does he say about his death and resurrection? Anyone remember who's read the book? And as far as that goes, about his ministry in general. If you recall, the author claims, it's a Jewish author, I believe, claims that Jesus came and deliberately attempted to fulfill certain messianic prophecies in order to show that he was the Messiah. In other words, it was a self-fulfilling type of prophecy. He planned it out. He and his disciples plotted, hence the Passover plot, plotted to fulfill those prophecies. Yeah, that's what. But in this book, the author is claiming that Jesus, you know, plotted or made plans. He and the disciples got together and planned out how he would fulfill prophecies. I suppose that would include faking miracles and all sorts of things like that. And then even his crucifixion was plotted, planned, because of, you know, Isaiah's prophecy about the suffering servant. Apparently it was understood at that time to be a messianic prophecy, even though some people today say that that's not a messianic prophecy. Apparently it was understood that way then, and clearly it is. But even his crucifixion, it seems, was plotted, if I remember correctly on how the theme of the book goes. But something went awry. They didn't plan that spear. And so Jesus, you know, he was to be drugged and have the appearance of death, placed in the tomb, then come out of the tomb, and so forth. But as it turned out, they didn't realize that a Roman soldier was going to thrust the spear into his side and that he would then bleed to death. I think, if I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, he supposedly lived a little while. Was it long enough for the disciples to steal him away? But he died, and they hid the body someplace. Of course, the body was never found, and they went around claiming he had risen. So that's where I get the title Passover Plot or Passover Plots, because there's not just one of them; there are many of them, many plots. That is to say, many claims about the resurrection of Jesus, and of course, his resurrection, his death, his resurrection, ascension. All of this is looked upon in the New Testament as one package, as it were, because Paul says that if Christ be dead, if he's died and has not risen, then we're still in our sins. So the resurrection ties in with the death, which of course is symbolized in the Passover. So that's why we're approaching the Passover season. That's why I think it's important that we say something about the resurrection and about the fact that he did rise from the dead, and the fact that he is alive today. Otherwise, the whole ritual, the whole symbolism of taking the bread and the wine and of recalling the events of Passover and making the connection with Jesus is an exercise in futility. If he did, let's take a look at some of these theories. And then I'd like to, if time permits, I'd like to read right out of the gospel accounts. And then I'm going to ask for some audience participation here, because we're going to be the jury today. We'll look at the charges that are brought against Jesus and his disciples. And then we will look at the accounts, listen to what the witnesses say. And then we'll analyze what they say and see if the charges stand up. Sound fair enough? Have to look at what the witnesses say. And of course, in doing that, there are some principles that we have to abide by. Some principles that we have to abide by. You have to, well, we'll get to that a little bit later, but for right now, let's consider some of the theories. The theories regarding, or actually these are theories attempting to explain the empty tomb. Because the fact is, you know, there is an empty tomb you have to deal with. He was placed in a tomb, there were witnesses. Not only the disciples witnessed it, But the Romans witnessed it, the Jews witnessed it, the whole world, as it were, knew it. He was dead, he was put in the tomb, and then the tomb was sealed. And now they have an empty tomb to deal with. So these are theories that attempt to explain, or explain around, or explain away, the empty tomb. The first one, and I'm taking this from a book entitled The Resurrection Factor by Josh McDowell. He lists several of these theories, but one of them he lists is the unknown tomb theory. The unknown tomb theory. And the argument goes like this. And if you'll think back, those of you who've been in the church for any number of years, it may sound plausible at first because we've always said, what did they do with common criminals? When the Romans crucified them, what did they do with them? Did they give them a decent burial? Remember the Valley of Hinnom? What did they do? Threw them in the pit. So is it likely that a man who is considered a common criminal, Jesus of Nazareth, was given a decent burial in a wealthy man's tomb? See, that's one of the arguments. No, it's more likely that he was thrown in a pit, his body was mingled with others, and they never, you know, was never seen from again. Sounds reasonable, doesn't it? So that's the unknown tomb theory. The second theory, we'll come back, we'll as we go through the scriptures and see what they actually say, we'll comment on some of these theories at that time. But you be thinking about the theories as we go along. Is the wrong tomb theory. The wrong tomb. According to this theory, he was placed in a tomb. So let's understand, in the community of Jerusalem, those rock-hewn tombs were numerous. And if you just went out into a place where there were all these tombs, we'd call it a cemetery, I don't know what they called it, you would have difficulty finding the one you were looking for. Ever heard that theory? And so the theory goes like this. The women, when Jesus was crucified, and they took his body to the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, the women came, watched from a distance, they saw the tomb, so they witnessed this, he was placed in the tomb, then they left, and they came back X number of hours later, a few days later, in order to anoint the body with spices, and they came to the wrong tomb. Now, what's the evidence for this? The evidence is, you find in Scripture that the tomb that they left was sealed, but the tomb they came to was open. So therefore, it must be a different tomb. So you see, you have this little bit of evidence in the Scripture, and we're going to talk about dealing with scriptural evidence in a little while, but there's this bit of evidence in the Scriptures that they came to the wrong tomb. And also, there's another little nugget, an element of evidence, if you want to call it that, that indicates that they came to the wrong tomb. Do you recall what the young man said? He said, he is not here. He also said, see the place where they laid him. And he must have been pointing to another tomb. That's actually been presented by scholars. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. And when the women realized that this guy knew why they were there, and they didn't want to be, you know, they were doing this in secret, well, it frightened them and they ran away. Well, that seems plausible on the surface, doesn't it? You know, these are certain scholarly, if you want to call these scholarly, explanations. Actually, explanations by those who simply cannot accept the possibility of something supernatural occurring. That's very important as you, the jury, consider these things, is this element of the supernatural. Well, let's go on to another theory. There's the legend theory. The theory is that the whole story about Jesus of Nazareth coming and claiming to be the Messiah, dying, and then being resurrected is just a legend. Probably was a man named Jesus, probably was a good man, a preacher of good things, and probably he died by crucifixion, perhaps not. But the whole thing is just a legend about his resurrection. And, you know, that's the one I think most people would stumble across who haven't really considered these things carefully, because, you know, the reasoning goes like this, and I've been, in years past, I've reasoned along these lines. Well, you know, there's how many religions in the world? How many claims are made for great men and great, almost godlike men? What about those who follow Muhammad? those who follow Buddha, those who follow this leader or that leader or the other, all these religions going back to antiquity, how do I know that this is not just another one that's a lot of myth? After all, it does talk about virgins giving birth, dead men rising, people walking on water, and things of that nature, so how am I to know it's not just a myth? So the legend theory is probably one that is among the more popular. And then there's the spiritual resurrection theory. The belief is that Jesus' body was still in the tomb, or a tomb. It was placed someplace, but it decomposed. And what the disciples saw was his spirit. In other words, it wasn't an actual raising of that body and coming out of the tomb. They saw his spirit. Kind of like in the Star Wars, you know, thing when Obi-Wan Kenobi got cut down and he later, you know, used the Force and started appearing there. Something like that. Huh? You saw Star Wars, didn't you? I'm not just kind of a manifestation. Probably heard a voice at first and, you know, saw this kind of a phantasm of sorts, and they realized it's Jesus. So a manifestation. He manifested himself so they could visibly see him, but he was a spirit. And what's the evidence for that? They do have little strands of evidence for that. Well, it tells us he appeared in a different form. It tells us Mary Magdalene didn't recognize him when she first saw him. He could appear and disappear mysteriously at will. So he must have been a spirit. So that's the evidence they use for that. So that's the spiritual resurrection theory. And then finally there is the hallucination theory. The hallucination theory. Now I talked to someone just this week who called me and wanted to tell me that it had been revealed to her that we were observing Passover on the wrong date this time, and her evidence was that she'd had all kinds of experiences. She saw all kinds of things happen. Things, I suppose, angelic beings or whatever appearing, signs taking place. And she sounded like a sane person. And, but you know, I had to conclude that this lady's hallucinating. The things she described that she saw. And I know it's just the fact that people do hallucinate. I mean, I've had people say that they have seen Jesus. Don't tell me he didn't have long hair. I know he did because I saw him. He appeared at the foot of my bed. He talked to me. I would say in general those are hallucinations, wouldn't you? How do we know that the people who said they saw Jesus were not hallucinating? Okay, we're going to examine that. You're going to be on the jury and help us determine what we do with the information we have, with the witnesses we have. Okay. So those are the theories. There are other ones, but those are the basic ones, and I think just about any other would fall under those categories. Pretty broad categories. And I would say that somebody's done an awful lot of work in order to explain away this idea that a dead man actually rose and came out of the tomb. Seems that there's a lot of hours have gone into explaining around that. And why do you suppose that is? And we're talking about people you find in the seminary. We're talking of theologians. Here's one here. I brought a book with me. I've used this before and referred to it in sermons in the past by John Shelby Spong. He's a bishop in the Episcopal Church. Entitled Rescuing the Bible from Fundamentalism. And he gives some of these explanations. He even says, he refers to Philippians 2 in verses 5 through 11, where it speaks of Jesus, how he humbled himself. He was took on the form of a servant. And said, therefore God has highly exalted him. And he goes on to explain. And this is not his own thinking. It comes from others, his colleagues in the higher critical school. He goes on to explain, that this passage says nothing about the resurrection. Nothing about the resurrection. It just says that Jesus took on the form of a servant and was obedient unto death. So you have about his death. It says, therefore God has highly exalted him. Meaning, it could mean that he was exalted in the spiritual realm. like you hear some preachers preaching somebody into heaven. You know, now that person has been, you know, they're in a much better state, a much greater state. They're there with God, and you're still down here, so they're a lot better off than you are. Something similar to that. And since he claims, so he uses this as evidence that that was probably one of the oldest hymns, and scholars generally do believe that Philippians 2, verses 5 through 11, was taken from a hymn that the church actually used in its liturgy. And he says, since this is one of the oldest hymns, it probably reflects the original belief, and that is that Jesus was raised spiritually, not physically, but his body was still there decomposing someplace, and what happened was in the spiritual realm. Here's what he goes on to explain, that from there, said they started making proclamations. Proclamations such as, Jesus lives. Now, what would that mean? Have you ever heard things like, in reference to, say, the civil rights movement? Someone may say, the spirit of Dr. King lives on in that movement. You know what they mean, don't you? So, in this Jesus movement, this movement that he started, people were saying, the spirit of Jesus lives on in the movement. So that was a proclamation. Jesus lives. Jesus is Lord. Jesus reigns. In that sense, in the sense that his spirit is alive and well in that movement. But then as time went on, and as it is with proclamations, eventually you have to explain proclamations, and you do so in the form of narratives. So the narratives developed. He lives came to mean he has risen. But originally, see, according to this particular source, originally, the concept of the ascension and the resurrection were united into one. There were not two separate things. They were the same thing. That is to say, when Jesus died, his spirit was taken to heaven, and his spirit is active in the movement that he founded. And so God exalted him and raised him in that sense. But later, as they began to say Jesus has been raised, they begin to think of it in an actual physical sense. His body coming out of the tomb. So you see where they're coming from? They say this gradually evolved until finally we have the final product, and it's called, you know, the gospel. So that's what you have in seminaries, and that's what we have to deal with when we're defending the faith. So let's see if we can defend it. So what I'll have to do, and I hope I have time to do it, is go and take a look at what the witnesses say. What the witnesses say. But before I do that, there are two principles that a jury would have to keep in mind in evaluating and analyzing the witnesses. Number one, you must realize that the theories or the alternative explanations must take into account all the facts or all the information that the witnesses provide, not just strands of information. I can take a strand of information from anything, you know, from something Matthew says or Mark or Luke or John. I can take one strand out of the body of evidence and I can make it say all kinds of things. For example, I gave you some examples already where it says that he appeared in a different form. Well, that's spiritual, isn't it? That's a spiritual resurrection, not a bodily resurrection. Or he appeared in a room or disappeared. Well, I could take that strand of information and then build the whole case, my theory, on that strand. But you see, a good juror, and certainly a good lawyer or a judge, doesn't rely on a single strand. He has to take the body of evidence as a whole. Otherwise, he's not doing his job. The second principle is that you must let the evidence speak for itself and not begin with preconceived conclusions. In other words, if I say, well, dead men don't rise, therefore Jesus couldn't have come out of the tomb, what I'm doing is saying the supernatural doesn't exist. Is that fair to say the supernatural doesn't exist? Just because I don't see it on a daily basis, or maybe have never seen it, is it really fair for me to judge at this point that the supernatural does not exist? No, because it can exist, I suppose. Since I've never seen it, how can I say that it doesn't exist? Since there are many people who claim that they have seen it, what am I to do with that? So anyway, it's erroneous to start off with a preconceived notion. Let the evidence speak for itself and then form your conclusions. So let's look at the evidence. First of all, go to Matthew 27. Matthew 27. See what this writer says. Obviously, I won't have time to read all of every account, but I'll read portions from each one. And then I'm going to, in the remaining time, I'm going to ask you to evaluate the evidence. Matthew 27, and beginning in verse 62. Next day, we're breaking into the account here, after the crucifixion. It says, next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said, while he was still alive, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' Therefore, order the sepulcher to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead. And the last fraud will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go make it secure as you can." So they went and made the sepulcher secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. What is Matthew doing here? He's providing us with all kinds of information. He's even naming names, talking about events. And therefore, he's creating a trail that an investigator could follow. If he says, "Somebody told me that someone said," that's a different matter. But he's saying what they did. They went and said to Pilate. And so he's leaving a trail there that any investigator in that period of time could follow. One thing that I need to say, first of all, before we continue, is has to do with the importance of the dating of the manuscripts. All of these theories, the theory that I just, the concept that Spong presents, and most of these other theories, rest on the notion that the writers wrote long, long after the fact, or after the actual event. The fact is, while it may be true that narratives grow out of proclamation, it doesn't happen in 20 or 30 or 40 years. It doesn't happen. It requires 200 or 300 years. And that's why some of the older liberal scholars claim that the New Testament was written way off out in the 2nd century, maybe even as far as the 3rd century. But guess what modern scholarship has uncovered? That not only was it not written out in the 2nd century, it was written much earlier than our most conservative scholars previously thought. All the books of the New Testament. And I think it was back in 79 or somewhere back in that period when one of the world's liberal scholars dropped a real bombshell on his colleague. His name is John A.P. Robinson. He was an Anglican scholar. He wrote a book entitled Redating the New Testament. And even though he himself is liberal, based on language studies, his conclusion in the book, and you can get it, I've checked it out of the library before, his conclusion is that every book of the New Testament was written before the destruction of Jerusalem. So he even dates the writings of all the New Testament before the most conservative scholars have done in the past. I say the Revelation is out in the 90s. He says, no, it was in the 60s. So what this tells you, this whole document came out of Palestine. It wasn't something written much later, and therefore it didn't have time to evolve into a lot of legends. Just did not have time. If it was written in the 3rd century, I would say, yeah, they got a point there. They had bits and pieces of information, and this bits and pieces of information over time picked up, you know, it became mythologized, and by the time it was put down on paper, it actually was greatly reworked. But no, that's not the case. We know that these books were written much earlier than even the conservative scholars had previously thought. There's even evidence that the book of Matthew, which is usually dated out in the, I think in the 50s, 56, I've forgotten the traditional date, may have been written and probably was written within 5 years of the crucifixion. That's not time for legends to start developing from the facts. So that's very important to realize that, the dating of the manuscripts. So we are dealing with witnesses who actually lived in the period in which these things occurred, not 2nd and 3rd century writers. but witnesses, viable witnesses, who say they saw, so this is what we saw, and this is our story. So let's continue on now with Matthew. Matthew 28 says, "Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week," and I don't want to get into this chronology and these sorts of things, "Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the sepulcher, and behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven," or had descended, this had done it earlier, "and came and rolled back the stone and sat upon it. The appearance was like lightning, and the raiment white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men." Here's some more trails he's creating, saying the guards saw it. "But the angel said to the woman, 'Do not be afraid,'" to the women, "'Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here." He's over in that other tomb. No, he is not here. Now, notice a while ago I mentioned in the wrong tomb theory that this is a strand of evidence that those who hold to that theory have used. He is not here. Okay? And that's what it says. He is not here. And also it says, "Come see the place where he lay." And then we assume, or they assume, he must be pointing to another tomb. But you notice what they leave out. There's a strand of evidence that they leave out here. "For he has risen as he said." You have to do a little ellipsis there and skip that part. And the thing is, this account is consistent with all the other accounts. Every one of them says, gives us the reason that he's not here. Not because you're at the wrong tomb, but because he's come out of that tomb. So you see how that using one strand of evidence with preconceived notions is a very poor way for a jury to approach this kind of subject. So let's put all the information together. We can't take that out. We can't take that out of the testimony. That's what they said. "Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead, and behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. Lo, I have told you." So they parted quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy, and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, "Hail." And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." Now, as we read these accounts, it seems like the accounts are conflicting. They're really not conflicting. Different writers are telling different portions of the story. And this is what you would expect good witnesses to do. Unless they've gotten together and hatched up a plot, then they're going to say the same thing and even use the same terms throughout. And a good judge, surely a good jury, would be able to recognize that there's something fishy going on here. But what you find in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is they all tell the same story, but they tell it from entirely different perspectives. And even though the accounts seem to contradict the order of events, if you read them, put them side by side, first time you ever do that, you'll have a little problem with it. Because Matthew says this happened, and then Luke says that happened, and it seems that they got their chronology out of order. But if you put a set of witnesses on the stand to tell you about an event that took place 2, 3, 5, 10, 15 years ago, and that event involved a lot of different players and a lot of different movement, as it were, then are you going to find them telling exactly in the same order the same story? No. If you do, then you know that there's a plot. But if they tell the same story but in a different way, then you know that they're reliable witnesses. So that's what you find with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And if you're ever trying to harmonize these and you have difficulty with it, we have a little short brochure on that subject that shows at least one way that can be done. There's several ways you can harmonize these accounts, and actually they don't contradict at all. They tell the same story, but each person tells it from his own perspective and using his own sources. Sources meaning other people who witnessed these things. Well, I won't read the rest of the account, but that's what Matthew tells us. And there's so much more we could read, but for time's sake, let's skip on over to Mark. Mark 15. And beginning in verse 42, "And when evening had come, since it was the day of preparation, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea, a respected member of the council, who was also himself looking for the kingdom of God, took courage and went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Here again, he's laying a trail of evidence that an investigator could follow. And Pilate wondered if he were already dead. And summoning the centurion, he asked him whether he was already dead. When he learned from the centurion that he was dead, he granted the body to Joseph. And he brought a linen shroud, and taking him down, wrapped him in the linen shroud, and laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out of the rock, and he rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. Now back to this theory about common criminals being thrown in the pit. There is one major problem with that, historically speaking, aside from what all the witnesses tell us, even historically. You remember back in 1968, I believe it was, when a certain young man, the remains of a certain young man, Yohanan, was found. He clearly had been crucified, but his remains were in a tomb, not in a pit. So what does that tell you? That all criminals or all crucified people didn't wind up in the pit. Some were placed in tombs. It depended on the situation. And here you have someone giving his tomb. Otherwise, I suppose the body of Jesus would have been thrown into the pit. But Joseph of Arimathea, being influential in the Jewish community, and influential Jews had a certain way with the Romans as well, you know, politics. And so he had was granted the body of Jesus to put in his own tomb. So there's nothing outstanding about that. There's nothing here that contradicts the facts of history. So that theory about the missing or the unknown tomb or unknown place of burial doesn't hold up. The facts of history fly in the face of it, as well as what the witnesses consistently tell us. Continuing on, chapter 16, and when the Sabbath was passed, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome bought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, they went to the tomb when the sun had risen, and they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the door of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone was rolled back. Must have been the wrong tomb. It was very large. What is wrong with that theory? The wrong tomb theory. Furthermore, Joseph knew where it was. The women had been there, and I couldn't help but, as I read that theory, and even on the surface it sounds plausible, but think about it. Is it really that likely that they went to the wrong place? It's not. It's really not. They'd already been there. They saw it. And there's something else. We probably won't have time to get to it. Maybe we won't. But another account tells us that when Mary Magdalene returned and told Peter and John about it, what did they do? Well, they jumped up and went to the wrong tomb also, didn't they? It seems that nobody knew where the tomb was. Peter and John went to the wrong tomb. Joseph of Arimathea, I guess, didn't know how to set them straight on it. He forgot where his own tomb was. The Romans must not have known. Because, you know, there's something else in all of this that's real important. And I don't know that it's even necessary that we look at all the other witnesses. They all say essentially the same thing. But as you go through, you start analyzing and looking at what the witnesses tell you, you realize that every one of these theories are built upon, number one, a preconceived conclusion. It's the wrong way to approach, you know, judging witnesses. And number two, they all are based on one strand of the evidence, and not the whole body of evidence. So some of these theories? What are some of the other errors you see, the problems with those theories in light of what the witnesses tell us? Anybody? And that's another. That what you just mentioned there, the concern about stealing his body, was another bit of evidence in all these strands of evidence as we put them together, that it was known where his tomb was. Everybody knew it, yeah. I mean, what would they be concerned? Say, why don't you just send some guards out there and kind of watch the area, keep anybody out? It'd be hard to find his tomb anyway. No, that's not what happened. Here's something that needs to be considered in all this. And this, first of all, you had a body of people. We'll call them the disciples. And they consistently tell us, we have their witness right here, they consistently tell us that Jesus was in the tomb, they knew where the tomb was, and that he came out of the tomb, and that they saw him. Not only do they tell us, and we could read the account, but you can read Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and even 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 through 8. Maybe we'll get to some of those a little bit later. But they tell us that they not only did they see him, but they touched him, and that he ate with them. Those are other strands of evidence that are missing in the theories, taking the spiritual resurrection theory. What does that tell you? Do phantoms eat? So he was not a phantom then, was he? He had an actual body. So this is something the disciples have, the empty tomb testimony. On the other side, you have the opposition, we'll call them. That consisted of Romans. Well, they had something in this. After all, it was their guards that were left there and still managed to lose the body. So they wanted to be involved in this lie. You know, claim that there was a lie, that they stole the body. Certainly the Jewish religious leaders. And they were vigorous in their opposition to this movement, this Jesus movement, if you want to call it that, that these people were carrying out. And their chief claim was right here, empty tomb. Not only empty tomb, we saw the one who came out of it. We touched him. We've been with him. We've eaten with him. He has taught us. And not only that, as Paul fills us in, not only one or two or three, you know, I can believe one person would hallucinate, but 500? And Paul says most of them are here with us today. Now, he's leaving a trail for any investigator to follow. All they have to do is go to the synagogues or places of meeting where the Christians are and find those people. You can rest assured they were all talking about it. Wouldn't be hard to find. And if you have that many people say, yeah, we saw him. He was there. We touched him. And you got more than the required two or three, I think. What do these people have? Well, they also have an empty tomb. And they've attempted to deal with it. They've attempted to deal with it by saying the disciples took the body. But remember, they were vigorous in their opposition. They would have done anything, certainly not above lying, they've already lied, would have done anything to show, you know, to stop this movement. You know, what is really interesting is that nobody here, in spite of all the efforts and the vigor in opposing this movement, nobody ever even claimed that they turned up a body. Didn't happen. So that's a big factor in all of this body of evidence. No pun intended. But nobody ever came up with a body.
There were so many different lies.
Yeah. Well, the first story was that the disciples stole him. That was kind of dismissed, basically, or by the multitude of people who saw him alive. If that story is to stand, somebody's got to produce a body. None was produced. The only body that was ever produced was living. So the theories in light of, all of these theories in light of what the testimony tells us, they just don't hold up. They're not based on all the evidence. So if you're going to judge the witnesses when they bring forth their evidence, then present, you know, take all the evidence into consideration. Not just build on one strand here or a strand there. I could take these and pull out a strand of evidence and make it say anything. Anything I wanted it to say. Mr. Van?
I have a book that's in pieces. That's Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, they rehearsed it.
Mm-hmm. Well, too, in all this body of evidence here, you have all the more, and more than just one strand, you have each of the witnesses telling the same thing in so many words. It's not like that the disciples were eager to jump on the bandwagon and get out there and get this message started, get this movement going. They all were afraid. They ran away. And it's most logical to believe that they would run away. After all, their leader had just been killed. Romans were not fun to deal with when they start crucifying people. You people get afraid. I would have been, I'm sure. I might criticize the disciples out here in the 20th century, but I'll bet you if I'd have been there, I'd have been one of them too that'd run off. And then they turn around and they're the same people who's giving their lives for this. Are we to say that they gave their lives for a movement? The Spirit of Jesus lives on in a movement? Or did something actually happen that profoundly changed their lives? So that's the obvious conclusion you have to come to. And what it was they saw Jesus. They touched him. He was there. Not a hallucination, and not one person or two or three children claiming to see a vision like in the story of Our Lady of Lourdes and all that, the Catholic legends. It wasn't something like that. I mean, he was actually there. And over in 1 Corinthians 15 is a very important scripture. I referred to it earlier. Let's just turn over there briefly and look at it. Beginning in verse 3, Paul summarizes the witnesses that account for these things. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 3, he says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried and that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas," that's Peter, "then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive." See what a trail he's creating there? You can follow up on that. If you're an investigator back then, you can follow up on that. So these are not things that they claimed that took place in kind of an otherworldly setting. You know, it was said that a long time ago in a place far away. No, these are eyewitness accounts. These are accounts of things that took place historically in the real world. And he claims here, Paul is able to claim that there were over 500 who saw him. And he doesn't even name everybody. He doesn't mention the women who saw him first. And you can go back and look at the accounts and see where those 500 would have seen him when he appeared in Galilee, where the disciples and others came there with him. But with that much testimony, that much evidence to consider, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming. And you can see why these people went out giving their lives. One comment about spiritual resurrection. We've always said that, the resurrection is spiritual, but understand what that means. It doesn't mean what Protestants speak of when they talk about a soul departing the body at death. You see, that's what the spiritual resurrection theorists are saying, that the resurrection takes place spiritually. The body is there, and that the soul or the spirit or whatever is revived and rises up. That's not what we mean when we speak of spiritual. We mean supernatural. And furthermore, the body, this is a misconception, and actually it has, I've run across this misconception even in our own circles, the idea that the body that went in the tomb was not the body that came out. Have you ever heard that? Or like Jehovah's Witnesses claim that his body, the physical body, dissolved into gases, but the spiritual body was what was raised. And that was even something like that was presented in the original copy of An Incredible Human Potential, but I noticed they edited it later. Actually, it was the same body. It was just a transformed body. Transformed. But it was the same body. How could Jesus say, "I am not a spirit"? When they saw him, on one occasion the disciples saw him when he appeared to them, they were frightened because they thought they were seeing a spirit, a manifestation of some sort, maybe a demon or whatever. And he said, "No, touch me. It's me." Yeah, you see, I'm flesh. I'm not a spirit. So, yes, it was a spiritual resurrection, but you understand what that means. It means supernatural. And it doesn't mean that he had an invisible body and was that body had somehow dissolved and he was now just entirely pure spirit that could not be seen or touched. No, he had the power of manifestation. And that body is the body he went in the tomb with. The one he came out with is the one he went in with. It's just a transformed body. And now, of course, subject to his command. He can dissolve it if he wants to and make it rematerialize if he wants to. But, that gets into another subject there. Now, I was going to let you be the jurors. Any other evidence, any other things that crossed your mind as we looked at these, at the evidence? Of course, we didn't read it all. Yes, sir?
Well,
Okay. So she was, and too, another thing in that account, it wasn't like she was hoping for a resurrection, because she'd run and immediately said they've taken his body. I mean, she's just like most of anybody else would have been. You don't automatically think, why, he rose from the dead. If you go to some tomb and you saw a body placed there and the body was gone the next day or a few days later, you wouldn't automatically think a resurrection has occurred. And so obviously she didn't, or she wouldn't have run to the others and told them. And they didn't believe it either. So it took him to actually appear there to get her to believe it. And, of course, the other disciples as well. Other items? They knew where the tomb was. Well, they didn't come running back, you know, running to the tomb after the ladies had left. And there were repeated visits to that tomb, two or three anyway. And I don't see any record or any mention of any searching and saying, you know, where is this thing? You know, nothing like that. And yeah, you find, like Mr. Vance said earlier, obviously there would have been the area where the stone was rolled, the trench, and then the clothing, the grave's clothes were in there. And then you had the guys, it says men in some accounts, what it was, obviously the angels appearing as men, who said, he's not here. He's in the other tomb. No, he's not here. He is risen, as he said.
He came out of the tomb before they rolled it back.
Oh, yeah, it didn't require the rolling back in order for him to come out. He could make his way out without the stone being rolled. It's just like he could get inside the room where the disciples were without the door being opened, and then leave without going through the door. Yes.
So they doubted.
They expected him to stay dead.
Well, you remember the woman that put the ointment on before he ever died.
Well, he told them over and over what was coming, and somehow they missed it. When it actually happened, they didn't you know, it was like they were shocked. Okay, yeah, well, it required faith for them too, even though they saw him. But you know, the faith is the belief. But you know, the thing you find consistently in the Bible is belief never does conflict with evidence. And what we're showing here today is the evidence is overwhelming that what the witnesses say actually happened. There's too many witnesses, too many strands of evidence to be put together to conclude that it was a hallucination or something of that nature. So he came out of the tomb. And he's the one in whom we place our faith. So with that, I think it's time for services.